Failure to leave the building as ordered will result in your arrest for trespassing.
We got your back. We got your back.
Organizers say 34 people were arrested last night at the Capitol during their protest over the 700-day-long budget impasse. Today's the big day. It's May 31st, the last scheduled day of legislative session. Civic Federation President Lawrence Massal explains what's at stake.
In the best-case scenario, we balance our budget. We know what our revenue is, and we match that against what our known expenditures are. And that's what the General Assembly has known for many months and what it needs to do in these waning days.
Plus, we talked to those directly affected by this budget impasse, including the faculty, staff, and students from NEIU, which yesterday said it would have to lay off 180 people because they're not getting funding from the state. Also, what happens when a high school student gives up her dream school? That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay with us. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. It's May 31st, the last scheduled day for state lawmakers, and it's day 700 without an Illinois budget.
Failure to leave the building as ordered will result in your arrest for trespassing.
We got your back. We got your back.
We marched 200 miles over 15 days for this budget in blistering heat and heavy storms, 20, 25 mile an hour winds. One more night is nothing.
34 people were arrested last night in protests at the Capitol over the budget impasse. Also yesterday, Northeastern Illinois University announced 180 layoffs because of a lack of state funding.
The people of Northeastern are our most valuable asset, and having to say goodbye to so many of them is heartbreaking. This is one more result of this 700-day-old budget crisis, a crisis not of our making.
That's University President Richard Heldobler. We'll hear more from faculty and staff later in the hour. But first, what could a budget actually look like? We've heard of the Senate's grand bargain, an attempt to tackle some of the budget issues the state is facing. It's not really clear at this point if lawmakers in the Illinois House have anything cohesive. And Governor Rauner's budget proposal has a $4 billion shortfall in it. The Civic Federation is a nonpartisan group, but it's long advocated for a more conservative approach to state funding. President Lawrence Massal has been outspoken about the need not just for a budget, but for one that actually solves many of our state's fiscal problems. He's here with me now, not just to talk about what lawmakers are debating, but what the Civic Federation has offered as its own proposals. Lawrence, welcome back to the 21st.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with the cost, Lawrence. We're looking at what? More than $15 billion backlog of bills, our credit rating in the toilet, these layoffs that we were just talking about. What to you are the biggest costs of all of this to the taxpayers of Illinois?
Well, there are three major costs. One, we are spending an enormous amount of money that we don't have without a budget. It's been 22 months since the state had a budget. That's not the same as not spending money. The state's incurring obligations in the billions of dollars in obligations that it does not have. But the unnecessary costs are the interest penalties and the other fees that are associated with not paying your bills. Having $15 billion in unpaid bills means that we are going to pay over $1 billion in penalties once those bills are paid. And so that's an unnecessary cost. It's a waste of money. In addition, the state's credit rating, as you pointed out, is the worst in the country. It's teetering on non-investment grade. The rating agencies are saying if the state doesn't get a budget soon, then it's going to face further downgrades. That means every government in Illinois, not just the state, but the cities and school districts and park districts, whenever they borrow money, they're already paying an enormous premium. They'll pay even more. That's unacceptable. The easiest thing we can cut in terms of waste in Springfield are our interest costs and our penalty payments that we make. Sometimes in the case of employee health and retiree health insurance costs, we're not even appropriating that money, but we're still paying a 12% a year penalty on that. That's ridiculous.
Is there any way, Lawrence, also to calculate the collateral damage from all of this? We're thinking about social service agencies that have closed, some of our most vulnerable citizens or residents falling through the cracks, students, other people who've left the state?
Well, it's easy to see in terms of the social services impact. When you walk around the streets of Springfield or Champaign or Chicago and you're confronted by a homeless person and you put some money in their paper cup and realize by talking to them, they don't need just $2 or $5. They need some real help. They have some mental health issues. The state hasn't been appropriating money for mental health services for years, and so that they're not getting those services. Those people end up in our hospitals and even worse situations with extraordinary cost. If you look at higher education, we're seeing a decline in enrollment in higher education, some of which is clearly tied to the uncertainty of the state budget. We're seeing universities and colleges, both public and private, cutting programs, cutting staff, uncertain whether the MAP scholarships will be offered or whether they'll be granted. That's sending absolutely the worst message to our best and our brightest that we want to stay in Illinois in our future. In addition, even elementary and secondary education, which gets appropriations from the General Assembly signed by the governor, aren't getting their categorical funding. So they're not getting their special education or transportation funds on a regular basis. We're hearing from some of the more rural or spread out districts in Elgin and in Aurora that if the state doesn't have a comprehensive budget this year, they probably won't be able to open their schools.
Lawrence, let's talk about specifics of budget proposals. Let's talk about, first of all, the Senate. What makes the most sense in what you think the Senate has proposed thus far?
Well, the Senate basically addressed the elephant in the living room for anybody who cares about the state of Illinois. We don't have enough money to pay all the obligations that we're incurring. By not having a budget, we're not saving any money. We're spending more. So the Senate legislation that moved over to the House includes about $5.4 billion in new revenue for the state that would be raising the individual income tax up to 4.95% and the corporate income tax to 7%, and also expanding the sales tax to include some services. That allows the Senate proposal to basically be balanced with spending of $37.3 billion. That's far better than anything we've ever seen in the last 22 months of the state of Illinois. It could be improved. We hope the House is going to take action to improve it and send it to the governor, but we're waiting to see. Today's a very big day in terms of the requirements for voting, needing a 3/5 after today to pass any immediately effective legislation.
Mm-hmm. Of course, another important point to why May 31st is an important day, why today is important. Last night, Lawrence, a House committee did approve one part of the Senate budget package, $37 billion spending plan paid for through a $5-plus billion tax hike. Are you seeing anything cohesive coming from House leaders at this point?
I think it's always difficult to predict what the General Assembly will do, especially in the waning days of the session. We're hearing more and more from members who are frustrated, who recognize that it's intolerable and unacceptable to try to operate again this year without a budget. The protests that you're seeing in Springfield are having an impact. The protests in Chicago and all around the state by government officials, local government officials, members of the General Assembly are having an impact. There is the potential to finally do what 49 other states do routinely when don't avoid, which is to every year pass a balanced budget.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that also happened yesterday, you were just talking about taxes, was that the Senate approved bills imposing a 2-year property tax freeze for school districts and local governments outside of Chicago. Governor Rauner called this phony. What do you think about this? What is the Civic Federation's position on property taxes?
Well, certainly the Civic Federation has long been a proponent of property tax reform and a better understanding. We could have a much more transparent system. We could basically share the burden of public education funding better by if the state was financially solid than it is. But the governor and others who propose knee-jerk property tax freezes that don't include specificity in terms of how those governments are going to operate, you can't say it in the same paragraph, we support education and we want to help elementary and secondary education, but we're going to freeze their property taxes and not tell them how they're going to fund their pensions, not tell them how they're going to make up for that loss of routine growth in their obligations.
So what other revenue sources should we be looking at?
We should be looking at the exemption. The largest exemption on the income tax right now is the retirement income. Every other state around us does taxes their retirement income. The federal government taxes retirement income. The Civic Federation Federation has estimated that we could exempt Social Security payments to retirees and basically still generate $2 billion in retirement income to the state by just following what the federal government does in terms of how it taxes retirement income and what our surrounding states do. We can't afford such a generous exemption at a time when we're not paying our bills, when we don't have enough money for mental health services, when we don't have enough money for our most vulnerable seniors and providing security for them to stay in their homes. It's time for Illinois to wake up and stop providing overly generous exemptions to retirees that prevent us from providing the services we need.
My guest is Lawrence Massal. He's president of the Civic Federation. And Lawrence, you know, some of our listeners have probably heard the news reports of the sale of the Thompson Center in downtown Chicago. That's sort of a one-time revenue boost. How much would a difference would something like that make to the state?
It's a very small amount of money. And in particular, if the governor is successful in selling the Thompson Center and it's torn down and rebuilt into a skyscraper or whatever the plan is for it, the money shouldn't be used to prop up the operating budget. It would be a one-time revenue source, most likely in the range of $200 to $300 million. We're about $5 billion short right now in terms of what we need. So in some ways, it's a very modest proposal. That doesn't mean the building doesn't need updating, doesn't need work, but it's not a panacea. The problem is the state has tried all the easy, politically attractive tricks. So whether it's expanding casinos or legalizing marijuana or selling the Thompson Center, it's not enough money for the structural deficit the state of Illinois has.
Lawrence, you've also said that the governor's proposal is something that you all do not think is worth supporting. Can you explain why?
Oh, no, there are many parts of the governor's budget proposal that we do support. We have real questions about how he closes or fails to close or add specificity to how he'll make up for approximately a $4.5 billion shortfall. The governor's budget includes a line working with the Senate on a grand bargain that his budgeteers estimate at about $4.5 billion. There was no specificity as to how that revenue or cut would be adopted. It's still controversial, but the fact that the Senate moved the budget over to the House gives the governor and the Illinois House the opportunity to build on it and improve it to the extent they can.
Lawrence, what do you think about the way that this has been done over the past couple of years in sort of a piecemeal fashion? And I'm thinking in particular of the fact that we've had K-12 funding appropriated separately from everything else. Do you think that I wonder if that's, and that's sort of a lot of the conversation is maybe we're going to see this again, maybe in the next week or two, we'll see again another 6-month budget. We'll see K-12 funded for a full year. So schools continue to operate again at a limited basis. To be clear, school superintendents have made a point that even though they're getting the funding, it's not at levels that they had before. What do you think the consequences are if that were to happen?
It's been a horrible mistake and a very expensive mistake to not have a comprehensive balanced budget. I believe the Illinois General Assembly and the governor backed into a mistake, which was to pick and choose, which programs they would fund, in particular elementary and secondary education. The state, even though it appropriates for elementary and secondary education, doesn't have enough money currently to pay for the categorical programs of elementary and secondary education. So school districts like Elgin and Aurora aren't getting their transportation and special education money in a timely fashion and are telling us they're not going to be able to open unless there's a comprehensive budget. The idea that you can build a budget by pieces and generate compromise by going after the most politically attractive areas and ignoring the politically difficult areas is an experiment that hasn't worked in Illinois. 49 other states only do a comprehensive budget because you can't bring people to the middle to compromise if they don't have to all sacrifice and if there's not the risk that the schools won't open or that the prisons won't be staffed or that the state employees won't be paid. You take away that risk and that pressure, you take away the movement to the middle that is needed by all parties and all sides of the General Assembly and the governor to do what's best for the state, which is have a comprehensive balanced budget.
Lawrence, we just have a minute left. We haven't even talked about pensions or where you make tough choices on what to cut. So I think what I'm just going to end by asking is, what do you think is Let's try to end on an optimistic note. What do you think is best case scenario of what happens within the next 24 to 48 hours?
The best case scenario is that the Illinois House moves on the Senate proposal, makes improvements to it, addresses some of the things that the governor has said that he would like, including the workers' comp and property tax relief, but that it's done with an understanding that a property tax freeze, hard freeze, that doesn't help education or doesn't find some other means to fund elementary and secondary education is not going to work and is not going to meet that goal. There has to be a seriousness about what we're trying to do. In the best case scenario, we balance our budget, we know what our revenue is, and we match that against what our known expenditures are. And that's what the General Assembly has known for many months and what it needs to do in these waning days.
Worst case scenario?
Worst case scenario is that they pass another partial budget that ignores the financial reality of the state, that ignores the fact that the credit rating agencies are saying further downgrade is likely without a comprehensive budget, and they go home early, or they go home this weekend without a commitment to balancing the state's budget before the fiscal year begins.
And that said, if that happens, what do you want taxpayers to know about where we're at right now, if that's the case?
If the General Assembly adjourns without sending the governor a budget that is comprehensive and balanced, we can expect increased costs, regardless of what the political statements are about property tax savings. You can expect increased costs in the state's borrowing, increased costs in the penalties that will pay for our unpaid bills, increased costs in just operating our government, and do real damage to the long-term viability of the state's major institutions.
That's Lawrence Missal, president of the Civic Federation, talking to us about this very big day in Springfield, what's ahead for everybody. Lawrence, as always, thanks for taking the time to speak with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks for the opportunity.
The 21st is made possible by the Library at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, fostering discovery by providing information curation and archival services to extend scholarly impact from Urbana-Champaign to the state, the nation, and the world. The University Library at Illinois.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. It's graduation season, and that means millions of high school seniors in the U.S. will be walking across that stage, receiving their diplomas, and taking an important next step, which for many includes college. Lots of thought goes into the college choice decision. There's always conversation around finding your dream school, getting in. And today, we meet someone who decided to turn down that school she always dreamed of attending for financial reasons. Emma Krupp wanted to attend Northwestern University since she was 8 years old. As a child, she pictured herself by the lake studying. She made a plan for the next 15 years of her life in which she would continue on from Northwestern to work for the New York Times. However, that all changed when she received her financial aid letter in the mail. Emma's online with us today to discuss how she made the difficult decision to give up her dream school. Hey, Emma, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Hi there, of course.
So walk me through first, and why was Northwestern University your dream school?
I think at first it was sort of just how, you know, picture perfect the campus looked when I was a kid. And then I got to high school, and I'd always wanted to be a fiction writer, but I joined the school newspaper sort of by happenstance, and I loved it. And after some research, I realized that Northwestern has this great journalism program, and it's fairly close to my home in the suburbs. So it felt like fate almost. It was too perfect.
I should say, in the interest of full disclosure, we are broadcasting right now from the Medill School of Journalism in downtown Chicago, of which I am also a grad. So that's the full disclosure of everything. I am a Medill grad. So when you thought about school, obviously you kind of had a plan. You think about journalism, Medill's a natural choice. When did you start thinking about the money side of everything?
Very vaguely, starting during the college application process, because of course, I mean, even applying to schools is kind of expensive, or it gets to be after you apply to more than one. But I sort of figured, I had some friends who had gone to Northwestern in the past and obviously gone to other colleges, and it sort of just worked out for them. They got enough money, it was fine, and I knew that I'd have to take out some loans. So I sort of just put that to the back of my mind until, you know, I figured out whether or not I was going to get in. But it didn't really set in, of course, until I got my financial aid package.
And what happened when you got that financial aid package, Emma? What did it look like?
I remember exactly where I was, actually. I was sitting on my bed, and I had just come home from musical practice or something like that. And I opened the email that had the financial aid package, and it was just, it sort of took my breath away. It was so much less aid than I had been expecting. And then I panicked a little bit and decided I needed to sit down and calculate, you know, how many loans I'd have by the end of graduation. And it just became too much. It became very clear that it was going to be too much.
And where did your family factor into this? Where did you think about, did your parents set a limit on how much they wanted to spend? Is this something where you were like, I'm doing this all on my own? How did that come about?
Yeah, my parents had planned to and do contribute to the cost of my tuition. They had an amount that they could give me every year. And, you know, any amount above that, I was going to have to cover myself either in loans or through working. So I knew I knew that I had that limit for what my tuition could be. And Northwestern just far exceeded that.
You wrote about this. You wrote that you received a lot of input from peers and from friends trying to sway you in one direction. Did someone even encourage you to sue your father for money? Can you share that story?
I was never told that directly, but I was told by a friend who was sort of sharing my story at a graduation party, that someone recommended that I do that, that they'd read somewhere that that had worked out for a student in the past. Oh, sue for his 401k, which of course is ridiculous, and I was never going to do that. But it was a suggestion that was tossed out.
And Emma, even your guidance counselor asked you, so you made the decision, I guess. You got to kind of the painful point where you were like, I can't do this. Did your guidance counselor, did she ask? I understand she even said, or I assume it's a she, sorry. Maybe it's not a she. It's a he. Okay, thank you.
Yes.
Your guidance counselor asked, he asked if you were positive about giving up your dream school. Did you feel like lots of people reacted to the whole idea that you were no longer going to go to your quote unquote dream school?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, of course, all of these people had my best interests at heart because they knew that this had sort of, it really had been a dream of mine for a really long time. And especially my guidance counselor, you know, was sort of there every step of the way with the whole application process and knew sort of all the anxieties I'd had about getting in the first place. So I think that, you know, he was trying to have, you know, keep an eye out for me and have my best interests at heart. But yeah, that was generally the vibe I got from people when I told them that I was pulling out of Northwestern.
We're talking to Emma Krupp. She wrote an article, Why I Turned Down My Dream School for Financial Security. She's in Chicago. I want to bring someone else into the conversation. Lisa Maselli is a guidance counselor from University Laboratory High School in Urbana. She's here to talk us through also the part that guidance counselors play in this. Hey, Lisa, welcome back to the 21st.
Thanks. Thanks for the invite.
Lisa, can I ask, what role do you think a guidance counselor plays in helping a student pick a college? It is hard, right? Like you were hearing Emma talk about how he was with her all the way there, and then she got to this point where she was just like, I don't think I can do this.
Sure, sure. I think our role is to listen and to help students kind of think through what is it that they are envisioning for their life after high school, and to help them think about these criteria that maybe they're looking at a location or a major or access to internships, but to also make them realize that there is not one college or university in the country that has a monopoly on giving them the best experience. So our role is to really help them have a broader view of colleges, because often students, especially like Emma, who are high achieving and who had dreams and goals and worked hard in high school, I mean, her ACT, her GPA are phenomenal. There's often a sense of, I've worked so hard, I deserve this outcome. And because we know the Northwesterns of the world and other high-tier schools are very hard to get into, we actually discourage students from having kind of a dream school. We want them to have a list of colleges that everyone on that list means just as much to them as maybe their dream in their head. We almost discourage them from ranking their schools. We want them to build a list that meets their needs and where they will grow and thrive regardless of the outcome.
Yeah, Emma, on reflection, now that you're, you know, you're some time away from this decision now, do you feel like that's maybe a more realistic approach to thinking about schools, like to maybe just have a kind of a group of schools instead of have your heart set on one place?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think part of it was that I had applied early decision to Northwestern, so it felt like it was very set in stone, and that once I got in, that was it. That was the end of the story. And I didn't really have as many second choices as I probably should have. That is something that was encouraged by our school, but I think sort of just the culture of the dream school got to me anyway, I guess. So yeah, absolutely. I would tell any person in that position who's applying for colleges to really don't get pulled in by the idea of there being like one place that is going to be perfect for you, because it's most of the time not true.
Lisa, that is hard, right? Because we do have kind of a culture of a dream school. How can guidance counselors play a role in kind of helping change that? Or how do you have an opportunity now to even have talk to parents and students about that? How would you like people to think about it? Yeah. How can we change that culture?
Yeah, when Emma said there's a culture that there's kind of expectations, or I'm not sure, Emma, if you were saying there's even a culture at your school where maybe kids find an early decision school. Because even the ED, I mean, I'm so proud of you in the article you wrote, and I'm also fascinated to hear if you were stuck in a situation where you got in early decision, and then because you were appealing financial aid, you couldn't apply anywhere else. Because that really gets to be a burden of the early decision agreement, which is binding. If you get in, they're expecting you to come. So our big cautionary tale is whenever a student or a parent brings up early decision, we basically ask right away, is there any expectation that you're going to have a financial aid package and be able to compare offers from multiple schools? Because if money is a big deciding factor, early decision is a big caution, because you really want to make sure that you can afford that school. Otherwise, ED can get into an ugly bind. And while you're appealing aid, as a high school counselor, you're not really supposed to release a transcript anywhere else because they already were accepted into a binding school. So I think the culture of the bragging rights, like I worked hard, I want to be able to say I went to this school over this school. I've had students come in and say, I'm not going to lie to you. I'm kind of wanting to go to the school because it feels good to tell people. And I'm not really sure if it even fits me better than the financially safe school I have. So I think we have to work really hard. And Nyla, it's interesting because we're starting conversations as early as freshman and sophomore year, not about college selection, but about parents modeling good behavior, about how they can set this message to say, look, where you go is not going to determine who you are or outcomes for you. And we use a lot of books, like Frank Bruni wrote that book, Where You Go Is Not Who You'll Become. Julie Lithcott-Hames wrote a book, How to Raise an Adult. Google has been very vocal saying they don't care where you go to college. They're looking for other skill sets. So I think the more we can educate younger families about that whole culture and this, I don't know, this outcome-driven, getting into a college is this trophy you get after 4 years of high school, that's the challenge we face.
Emma, do you feel like that's what motivated you to write this article?
Yeah, I just felt like it's something that's not talked about very often. I mean, of course, you know, there's the question of students being able to go to college at all. And I'm very fortunate to have been able to go to college at all, but something that's, you know, you just don't hear as often about people who had to give up that idea of, you know, the idea that you've earned going to a certain college, you know, that you pay your dues in high school and you work really hard and you go to the college and that's sort of the happy ending to your story. When in reality, you know, it doesn't work out that way for a lot of people. And I hadn't seen a lot of that, especially when I was going through that process. And I figured, you know, if it gives at least a couple of people who are in that situation comfort, then it's worth writing.
Yeah. And so now, Emma, you're at DePaul, still studying journalism?
Yes.
So your choice of school has not changed your choice of your career outcome?
No. Yes, that's correct.
And that's clearly also, I think, the message you want to send to people, too.
Yeah, absolutely. And that there are different avenues to achieve, you know, the success that you want to attain. I mean, obviously, I'm a junior in college. I'll be a senior next year. I don't know where my career is headed or how successful I'll be in the long term. But I know that, you know, I've still had access to internships and I've had really, really great professors and classes that I've taken here. And I never really thought about that because I was so tunnel visioned about, you know, getting into Northwestern, going to Northwestern, having that journalism program, that I didn't consider all of the other options that are out there.
And can I ask you about the timing too? Because I wanted to bring up something that Lisa brought up about early decision. May 1st is the date when students have to commit to college. How did that affect you?
Right. So my negotiations with Northwestern and their financial aid office extended past May 1st. So I ended up actually having to take a gap year. I had decided at that point that I pretty much wanted to go to DePaul. It had been one of my second choice schools. And they offer a large merit scholarship to incoming freshmen that makes it possible for me to go here. But unfortunately, that is voided past the May 1st deadline. So I did take a gap year after graduating.
And Lisa, can I ask you about that? Like how, because it ended up, how do students juggle that? I'm curious about what advice you have for people with that as well.
Yeah. Another thing that we're doing very early with families is talking with them about responsibilities in this process. So for instance, Emma, as a high school student, was doing her job. She was working hard, doing extracurriculars, leadership, writing essays, building relationships with teachers for letters of recommendation, taking those darn tests. So she had a job to do. But families also have a job to do. The parents really have to be aggressive. And now we're even telling families as early as 9th and 10th grade to start going into calculators and calculating expected family contributions, possibly even going into a college like Northwestern. If that's your dream when you're 9 or 10 years old, you could actually go into a net price calculator that is linked to the college's website and put in your income and actually see what college would expect you to possibly pay. Granted, it's not an exact thing, but it gives you a snapshot. And I think sometimes, I mean, I just visited Grinnell College a year or two ago, and their financial aid officer said, we want sophomore and junior parents to come to us with their EFC, their expected family contribution calculated, go into the net price, bring us that figure, and we will sit down and have a realistic conversation about, is this college going to be affordable for you? So that when you build that college list, there won't be so many surprises that in the end, it'll be these painful, tearful conversations of having to let go of something. Now, sometimes, Nyla, that's not necessarily the easiest thing to do because a merit scholarship, like Emma mentioned, may not be in any of those early predictors because they're not going to be able to tell you if you qualify for an honor scholarship when you're doing things as early as 9th or 10th grade. So merit aid can kind of sneak in and make a college possibly more affordable. But our recommendations now to parents are do your homework while your student is working hard, doing their tasks. Please, I beg of you, go into these calculators, make sure that you understand how the snapshot of your family picture is going to be looked at by both federal methodology and institutional methodology. And I encourage them always to apply with every financial aid form they can because the student aid report that comes back after you do the FAFSA will give you that EFC, that expected family contribution. And if parents do their early work and are not intimidated by financial aid officers, call them. Have early conversations. Say, my son or daughter has you on their list. We want to make sure that we're looking at the right school to see how you'd package a family like us. Those are conversations that any aid officer would have with a family.
Lots of good advice from the Director of College Counseling at University Laboratory High School, Lisa Miscelli. I want to thank also a DePaul student, Emma Krupp, for joining us. We'll tweet out her article, Why I Turned Down My Dream School for Financial Security. Emma, Lisa, thanks for being with me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, of course. Thank you.
Thank you. And nice meeting you, Emma.
Nice to meet you, too.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We started the program talking about the protests yesterday evening at the Capitol. Organizers of a group called the People's Lobby said 34 of its activists were arrested during protests over the budget impasse. It was the final stop in the activist-led march to Springfield. The group had walked more than 200 miles over the past 2 weeks from Chicago to the State House. I'm joined now by Christy Sanford, the communications director for the People's Lobby, who was at the protest yesterday. Christy, welcome to The 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Christy, why did you all march from Chicago to Springfield?
We marched because we wanted to put forward a positive vision for our state. We know that people all across the state from all walks of life are suffering, and some are even dying because there is not a state budget that puts the needs of our people and our communities first. And so we have a budget proposal, and we think that it's a great proposal to fully fund higher education and make tuition free, to give the people of Illinois free universal health care, to fix our infrastructure, to transition us to green energy, and to fully fund our K-12 education, among other things. And so we thought, what's the best way to get this vision out into the public arena? Let's do a march in the tradition of many activist movements in the civil rights history as well. Let's march to Springfield and let's talk to people all along the way about our vision for the state of Illinois and what they need in their communities.
Yeah, Christy, who was in your group and what kind of people did you talk to along the way?
So the march was organized by Fair Economy Illinois, which is a coalition that the People's Lobby belongs to. And we stopped in numerous towns, and we really relied upon the generosity of strangers to put us up for the night and to feed us. So numerous religious congregations, individuals took us into their homes. And we also held a series of listening events along the way where people from the community came together and we asked them, you know, what do you need to make your communities better places to live? And we shared our budget proposal and got people excited about our vision and asked them to engage with us going forward into building legislative support for our proposal.
So last night, you all did have you were in the Capitol. It was pretty late. I think it was about 20 to midnight by the time the last person was one of the last folks was, I think, arrested. What's your plan for today, now that given that today is sort of the last scheduled day of session, the last day for the legislator to pass the budget? What's the next step for you guys?
So our next step, we've actually been working on progressive revenue solutions for the past 5 years because we've had a problem with our state budget long before Bruce Browner became governor and actually refused to cooperate with Democrats on an overall budget. We've had a lack of investment in our communities. And so we will continue to work on closing corporate tax loopholes and building support for our proposal to tax LaSalle Street and to win a progressive income tax. So today we're resting because we're exhausted, but in the months going forward, we will continue to organize and push for that agenda, and we do believe we will win.
That's Christy Sanford with the People's Lobby. Christy, thanks for being with me.
Thanks for having me, Nyla.
You know, as we've been talking about this budget impasse, we know that state universities, Christy was just talking about this, state universities have struggled because of the failure by Springfield lawmakers and the governor to pass a budget. This has been for the past 2 years. And while much of state funding to different groups has continued to get passed through, even if it's very delayed, we know that public universities have seen drastic cuts in funding from the state. In the interest of full disclosure, I should remind everyone who's listening that our staff on this radio program at Illinois Public Media are employed by the University of Illinois, and therefore we're all state employees. For some schools like Chicago State, last year that meant 400 people were cut, 40% of its staff. Eastern Illinois laid off about another 400 people last year. And yesterday, an announcement from Northeastern Illinois University regarding 180 jobs cut. 130 civil service employees and 50 administrative professionals will receive layoff notices within the next 6 to 7 weeks. These cuts to staffing are 1/4 of employees in each department. President Richard Heldobler said from June to September, the school must fill a $10.8 million budget shortfall. The cuts are expected to save $9 million.
As a professor, I'm accustomed to giving grades. If I had to give a grade to Springfield for the handling of our state's budget, they'd get an F. Northeastern is counting on our lawmakers to do the right thing for our students, our state, and our economy by passing a budget that includes adequate funding for higher education before it's too late.
That's NEIU President Richard Helldoppler at a news conference yesterday announcing the cuts. I'm joined now by three people from NEIU's campus in Chicago. Timothy Barnett is an English professor and the vice president of Northeastern's faculty union. Stacey Elikakos is a graduate student and advisor and a member of AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. Yadira Alonso is an undergraduate student majoring in biology. Timothy, Stacey, Yadira, welcome to the 21st. Thank you for being with me.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Tim, let me start with you. How are faculty and staff members responding to the news yesterday?
It's been building for a while. It's been 2 years, as you've noted. And I think with further sort of depression and malaise and fear and worry about being open, and even if we are open with such big cuts, how will we manage to work with our 9,000, 10,000 students come the fall? So a lot of fear, I think, a lot of anxiety, and as I said, it's been going on for so long now that it's really been weighing very heavily.
Stacey, how about you? How about AFSCME folks, graduate students, other civil service? That's where the bulk of this cut is coming from. What are you hearing from that portion of the campus?
So at this point, we haven't received our layoff notices yet, so there's a lot of fear. Just offhand, I know people were really distressed in the restrooms, crying. People are very concerned, and I know students, myself, were worried about how long the school can continue to stand if it needs to keep cutting, and we have no expectation of money. So people are concerned whether they can finish out their programs. That's something that I worry about. And a lot of students, especially coming in as an advisor, you know, they ask, is the school still going to be open in the spring? Is it going to be open for their siblings? So it's really a concern that stretches out.
Yadira, you're a biology major. What year are you?
I am about to be a junior this fall semester.
And are you worried about whether the school will be able to stay open?
Yes, for sure. You know, I know last semester our classes were canceled due to the cuttings, and it got to the point where our classes had to have either a quiz or an exam every time we met, and it was very stressful, you know, to know that we had to cut classes to the point where we had to cut our review day for our final exam. And the day was four log, so meaning that all the class, the resources were shut down, like the library. So we did not have a place to study for finals. We ended up going to a public library, but the public library ended up closing earlier, and we ended up at North Park University. It was very upsetting to, you know, look for other places to study where I'm paying to come to NEIU and to get my education, but I have to look to other places because of the budget crisis, because Springfield can't get it together and, you know, create that budget that we need to keep our school open. Also, as a student orientation leader on campus, I work with incoming freshmen and transfer students, and the most commonly asked question that I get personally is NEIU going to be open, you know, for the next semester or the next year? And it's just very upsetting to me because I would rather have students ask more meaningful questions such as, you know, my relationships with my professors, you know, if I like the school, you know, what are the resources available? So it's just very sad to hear that I'm here to help students, incoming freshmen, and obviously I don't really have an answer to is the school going to be open, but I'm just, you know, hoping for the best, and I'm hoping that this, you know, situation comes to an end and they can, you know, fix it and have that budget that we really need to keep a university open. It has created so many barriers for a lot of our students. You know, we come
and it
here
sounds like, Yadira, it sounds like it's created a lot of stress for you. I mean, as you're describing this, it also seems like a huge amount of stress in addition to the normal stress that everybody has going through college.
Yeah, you know, I just want everybody, you know, to come to NEIU, and, you know, one of the reasons I'm here is because it's very affordable for your university, very, you know, prestigious school, because, you know, our education is important to all of us, and, you know, as I am an undocumented student, and I am here because of its price, because of its size, and I wouldn't be able to afford to, you know, transfer to another school like UIC, like DePaul, because they're, you know, higher prices than NEIU. So my four-year university has always been NEIU, always been my number one choice, so I wouldn't want to change that, you know, because of the budget crisis, because Springfield can get it together.
Right, and also as an undocumented student, I don't know if you have Dreamer status or not, but I know that adds a whole other layer of complication for transferring. It sounds like you're also still doing, I know you're a student ambassador for the college, it sounds like you're still doing a great job of that, Yadira, in spite of all of this. Professor Barnett, are you worried about fall enrollment numbers? What are sort of the faculty seeing on that side of things as well?
From what I've heard, our numbers have been going down fairly steadily, which is a regular trend across not just the state, but really the country. So we've been dropping a bit, and right now we're, I think, a little bit lower than where we would like to be, but not significantly. I think the fear is that as months go by, we do know that Illinois is the greatest number or percentage of students and faculty and others leaving the state, that people are really just running quickly if they can. So we've lost several 10 to 15 to 20 faculty members in the last year or two. I know lots of students have left, so that we're plugging along. And the big quandary, I guess, we have is that we want to be honest with students that we really don't know what's going on, and we want to be open that this is a real threat while at the same time not scaring students away and therefore making a shutdown that much more likely. So it's really been a fine line, and we're really trying to play all sides. And I just will say that the faculty and staff and students here are extremely dedicated to our urban mission and have been working extremely hard, and we will be here as long as we possibly can be, and we're counting on the state to help us.
Professor Barnett, what message would you want to send to lawmakers and to the governor?
Well, you know, I mean, one thing that's made a big impression on me, I don't know if you're familiar with the Center for Tax and Budget Accountability office. They're nonprofit and they're nonpartisan. Ralph Martiri is the director. I've heard him speak several times. He comes from a corporate background, and they've been in business, not even in business, it's nonprofit, for 17 years studying what makes states run, what makes things work. And the two things that they have found through numerous studies based on numbers is that the biggest things to help state economies are investments in higher education and investments in infrastructure. And so I would like, for a long time now, I've been wanting the governor, I've been wanting our representatives, our senators, to sort of address the numbers, the specifics, the studies, the details that the Center for Budget and Tax Accountability has come up with, and just either tell me, A, they're wrong, or B, how come we're not following that advice?
See, we just have just less than a minute left. I wonder if really quickly, what's your message you want people to know, and what message do you want to send to lawmakers and to the governor?
Here's to me.
Stacey, yeah.
Yes. So I think if only they could hear the on-the-ground stories that are happening to the people who work here, who are so committed to this community and the families that are connected to them. And I mean, the connections between the services that the state provides, which are also held up because of the budget or suffering, and how that impacts our students and comes back and impacts us as workers and students and teachers. So I just think that this is, public education is such a core of a citizenship, of a community. And there's so much that is surrounded by that, that really, you know, Governor Rauner having preconditions to pass what is so central to our, you know, to our livelihoods, is a big mistake. And I think that, you know, I want other people to know that this doesn't have to be a disaster. We really need some brave legislators who can step up and, you know, support what means most to a lot of the people that live in Illinois.
I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there, but I want to thank Stacey Alikakos. She's a graduate student advisor, member of AFSCME, Professor Timothy Barnett, who teaches English and is also the vice president of the Northeastern's Faculty Union. And, of course, I want to thank as well Yadira Alonzo, an undergraduate student, a student ambassador. All of you, thank you so much for joining me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
For all of you listening, we're at day 700 without a budget. As you've been listening to these folks, I wonder, how does this make you feel? Are you angry? Who do you blame for this? We'd love for you to leave us a voicemail. That number is 217-300-2121. We'll air what you have to say on tomorrow's program. Again, our phone number, 217-300-2121. You can tweet us. Our handle is 21STShow, or you can send us an email, talk@21stshow.org. All of this information is at our website, 21stshow.org. We want to hear from all of you on this issue. What's at stake for you in this budget impasse? Please give us a call, tweet, or drop us an email. That does it for us today. Stay tuned to this NPR station throughout the day. IPR's Brian Mackey and the rest of his team are covering all of the action in Springfield. They'll have the latest for you throughout the day. By the way, if you want to follow on action on social media, our Twitter account, again, 21STShow, will be tweeting out all the news from Springfield as well. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, broadcasting today from the Medill Newsrooms in downtown Chicago. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.